Hello. For the next two lessons, we're going to be looking at the judge, Samson. He's rather a unique judge. He's kind of the Mr. Universe of the Old Testament. We're going to be dividing up the section of Judges that deals with him into two parts, chapters 13 and 14, and then chapters 15 and 16. So let's begin, if we could, at chapter 13, verse 1. Now the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines 40 years. Now, the Philistines are a group of the Aegean people. They tried to invade Egypt somewhere around 1250 B.C., but they were repulsed, and they settled on the southwest corner of Palestine. If you look at a map, there should be a map somewhat like this in the back of your Bible. This one happens to be Canaan, divided among the 12 tribes. Right along the coast here, next to the tribe of Judah and Dan and Simeon, are the five cities of the Philistines. And, of course, they have city-states, like the Greek Aegean islands from which they came. And these guys are the only uncircumcised group in the whole area. They are a mercenary type of people. But instead of coming in and trying to defeat Canaan, they really did a more subtle temptation. They came in and settled and became merchants and kind of intermingled with the Jewish people, intermarried, started commerce, started trade. They brought the technology of the Iron Age with them. We learned, I believe it's from, I believe it's 1 Samuel 13, verses 19 through 22, that the Philistines were the only ones who had iron weapons, and the Hebrews had to go to them with their plows sharpened, their knives sharpened, and they really had the technology advantage. They also had chariots, which means they controlled that coastal plain, but not the foothills where the Judeans lived. So that's who the Philistines are. Matter of fact, the word Palestine is a derivation from Philistines. This same cycle of evil we have been seeing now time after time. The people, a generation grew up that did not know the Lord. They begin to go after the other gods, and God punished them by sending a foreign nation. Now, remember, the punishment was to bring them back. The punishment was a loving father to bring his people back. But they would not, and they would not, and they would not, and they would not. This vicious cycle shows the faithfulness of God and the irresponsible faithlessness of his people. Now, notice it says, 40 years. Now, 40 years... there's so many uses of the word 40 in the Bible. We got it rained 40 days and 40 nights. We got Moses up on the mountain 40 days. We got 40 years wilderness wandering. Jesus tempted 40 days. Most of us think that sometimes the word 40 is pretty literal. It means something over a lunar cycle. But many times it's just a long period of indefinite time. Okay? 40 years here. One generation, if you would. There was a certain man of Zorah. Now, we learned this place several times. We learned it from Joshua 19:4. It was a Danite city. Now, in the end of the book of Judges, part of the tribe of Dan is going to move to the very north. You're maybe familiar with the expression, from Dan to Beersheba became kind of a phrase for all of the promised land. Well, the Danites are going to move north at the end of the book of Judges. But right now, they're just to the west of Benjamin, not quite to the seacoast. And that's this area here. The family of the Danites, whose name is Manoah, and his wife was barren. Now, how often that's been the case? Barrenness and leprosy were kind of viewed as divine curses. It has been throughout the Old Testament so far that most of the women who had children that God really used were barren women. Why? To show that God is sovereign. Another way that same truth is shown, it's never seemingly the firstborn son who was culturally the one it should have been, but God always picked another one to say, I'm in control. I'll do it my way. I'm sovereign. So here is a barren woman. She had no children. Now, for a Jewish culture, that was just really a tragedy. Somehow, the older parts of the Old Testament even imply you live on in your children. Barrenness was a terrible curse. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman. Now, this angel of the Lord is just repeated throughout this chapter. I'm amazed how many times it's called the angel of the Lord. It talks about, and they prayed to God, and he sent the angel. Now, there are two ways of looking at this. There are some passages where the angel of the Lord seems to speak for God. It seems to be a theophany, or the presence of God. Many of us believe it may be the pre-incarnate Christ. Let me give you a series of verses. First, where the angel of the Lord seems to be deity. Genesis 16, 7 through 13, Genesis 22, 11 through 15, Genesis 31, 13, Genesis 48, 15 and 16, Exodus chapter 3, verses 2 and 4, Exodus 13, 21, when compared to Exodus 14, 19, and Zechariah 3, 1 and 2. And we see that several times in here, especially down in verse 22, when it says that we have seen God, we're going to die. They thought the angel was deity. And up in verse 11, where the angel says, I am, which is the covenant name for God. These are strong indicators that what we have here is another physical presence of God. But there are some other scriptures that seem to separate the angel and God, make a distinction between the angel and deity. Genesis 24, 7 and 40. Exodus 23, 30, Exodus 32, 34, 1 Chronicles 21, 15 and following, and Zechariah 1, 12 and 13. A distinction is made between the angel and deity. We can see it even in this passage. Look at verse 8. Notice it says, the Lord said, O Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come. There's a distinction there. Look at verse 10. He's called the man. In verse 8, the same thing. O Lord, let the man of God come. And it's repeated in verse 9. God listened, it says in verse 9, and he sent the angel of the Lord. There's those two distinctions. So I think it's always a representation of deity. There are some places where it says the angel of the Lord, and it's just another angel. But there are these specialized usages, and I hope you'll look them up. Now notice, if you will, where it says, to the woman said to her, behold, now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. Don't you, that lady was ecstatic? Now, therefore, be careful. And he's going to give her a series of things not to do. And there's several of them. Look at these. Number one, do not drink wine or strong drink. Number two, nor eat anything unclean. Number three is down in verse 5. And no razor shall come upon his head, for the boy shall be a Nazarite to God from his womb, from your womb. Now, the concept of a Nazarite is a particular vow within Judaism. It's described and explicated in Numbers chapter 6. We have several representations in the Old Testament of Nazarites, and of course Samson is going to be one. The word seems to mean to separate or to consecrate. Matter of fact, there's a couple of mentions in the New Testament. Luke 1:15 mentions John the Baptist. And in Acts 18:18 and Acts 21, verses 23 through 26, we know that Paul took a Nazarite vow. There are two kinds of Nazarite vows. A limited one, the rabbis say, for at least 30 days, and a permanent one, which would be John the Baptist and Samson. And so here is those very specific references. Now, when it goes, I want to talk about strong drink wine or strong drink. Now, wine here, this is one of the things you could not use any fruit of the vine whatsoever. Strong drink is when they add fermented grains or certain kind of spices to regular fermented wine that heightens the alcoholic content. And they're used quite often together in the Bible. Notice it mentions here then, or eat anything unclean. And of course, this goes back to the Levitical food laws. And then no razor shall be upon his head. I want to say again to you that long hair was a symbol of dedication to God. The soldiers of the Israeli army had long hair. And so I think it's important we remember that. The length of the hair in our culture sometimes speaks of a different kind of symbol. But in the ancient world, it's a symbol of dedication to God. And that's what we have here. Now, this no razor shall cut his head. You may want to see there's several relationships to this. The cutting of the hair was sometimes linked to cults, and that made it evil. Let me give you a few references. Judges 5:2, Deuteronomy 32:42, and 2 Samuel 14:26. You might want to compare those about the use of a razor. Notice it says, and he began to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. Notice the way he put that says that it won't be complete in the life of Samson, but Samson is going to start the conflict and going to begin to win the battle. And I think we'll see that as we progress through here. Then the woman came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me, and his appearance was like the appearance of the angel of God, very awesome. Now, Josephus, and I brought a copy of it here. This is the Flavius Josephus. It has two different books, The Wars of the Jews and The Antiquities of the Jews. He lived about during the time of Christ, a little later maybe. And he was a Jewish, but he wrote a history for the Romans to explain the Jewish faith. He has an elaborate account of this. He says that Manoah was jealous. His wife was beautiful, and he was jealous. And when his wife said that this angel was very handsome, he got even more madly jealous, and the Lord had to send the angel back so he wouldn't be so jealous. Oh, my. That's reading a bit much in here, I think. Now, when it calls him the man of God, that's the usual title for prophets. And she did not recognize it was a theophany or the presence of deity. And I did not ask him where he came from, nor did he tell me his name. Now, this asking of his name becomes a very important thing. Remember when Jacob wrestled with the angel at the brook Jabbok, and he asked the angel his name, and it was a very difficult thing, Genesis 32:29. Also, you might remember when Moses said to God, who shall I say sent me? Remember in Exodus 3:14-15, and then another mention of this, Exodus 33:17. The Hebrew name is a very important thing. It represents the character of someone. And so she didn't ask where he came from or what his name was. She just felt like it was a word from God. But he said to me, behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and on he went to the Nazarite vow. Then Manoah entreated the Lord, notice the word Yahweh there, that's the covenant name for God when it's all caps, and said, Lord, please let the man of God whom thou sent come to us again, that he may teach us what we shall do for the boy who is to be born. Now, that's not a good motive to me, and what I think it's talking about is, as you know, fathers train their son in some occupation. And it seems that Manoah wants to say, now, God, what do you want me to train this boy to do? Is he to be a, what is he to do? Teach me what I should teach him. That was the reason that he says for the angel to come back. Now, notice if you would, and God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of the Lord came again to the woman as she was sitting in the field. Now, again, she was alone. Apparently, she ran to get her husband so he could see the man, too. And he came, and Manoah rose and followed his wife, and they came to the man. Now, this word, the man here, I think is interesting. He looked just like a normal man, and they thought he was just from God, but they thought he was a prophet. Okay, nothing more. Are you the man who spoke to the woman? And he said, I am. Now, of course, that could be just regular grammar, I am, but it's not. It doesn't leave a Jew when he sees this very comfortable, because the name I am is the covenant name for God, Yahweh, from Exodus 3:14. I am that I am, the Hebrew verb to be. And this same title is what Jesus uses for himself several times in the Gospel of John, example, John 8:57-59. You might want to look at that. So I think there's an implication of deity here by the way he answered, even though it is a regular kind of grammatical construction. Now, when the words come to pass, what shall a boy's mode of life and vocation be? The angel, look at verse 13, he repeated exactly what he said to the woman. He said, just let the woman do what I told her to do, and didn't elaborate anything, and re-spoke the words right there in verse 14 that deal with the Nazarite vow. Then Manoah said to the angel, please let us attain you while we prepare a kid for you. Of course, this is not a goat. It's very much like Genesis 18. Oriental hospitality said they had to fix this man a dinner. It's going to take a long time to cook this goat. I mean, like several hours. This man's going to stay. He's going to say, I'm not hungry. I'm not going to eat your food. But if you sacrifice it to the Lord, show that separation again, then I will stay and help you do that. And again, look at verse 18, verse 17. And Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, what is your name, so that when your words come to pass, we may honor you? And the angel of the Lord said to him, why do you ask my name, seeing it is... Now, my New American Standard says wonderful. If you look at the same word in Genesis 18:14, it's the word difficult. If you look at the same word in Isaiah 29:14, it's the name marvelously wonderful. And so it just means beyond your comprehension. The angel is going to do some marvelous signs. Matter of fact, in verse 19, they put the kid and the grain offering and offered it on the rock, definite article there, to the Lord. Now, this rock seems to me to remind me back of what happened to Gideon back in Judges 6:19-21, where the angel caused the fire to come out of the rock and consume the sacrifice. Now, notice your Bibles in verse 19. And he performed wonders while Manoah and his wife looked on. My New American Standard has the he capitalized, which means that this translation committee is assuming this is a reference to deity, which shows they think the angel of the Lord is a divine presence here. Okay? And it came about that when the flame went up from the altar toward heaven, the angel of the Lord ascended in the flame on the altar. Oh, my, what that must have been like. Woo! And notice what happened in verse 22. When they saw this, Manoah and his wife said, "We shall surely die, for we have seen the Lord." There was a belief in the ancient world that to see God, he was so holy, goes back, I guess, to the account of the quaking of the mountain at the Exodus experience and the giving of the Ten Commandments. You might want to see several places where this is assumed you see God and die. Genesis 16:13, Genesis 32:30, Exodus 33:20, Exodus 20:19, Judges 6:22-23, and Isaiah 6:5 are some of the places where this same view is. But his wife is a very pragmatic lady. She said, "Look, he wouldn't have given us this prophecy just to kill us. The fact that he told us I'm going to have a baby and all of this means he's not going to kill us because he went upright in front of us." That's a pretty good thought, lady. Pretty pragmatic there. In verse 24, the woman gave birth to a son and named him Samson. Now, some think it's connected to the word sun because there's a city after the sun god in this area. I'm not sure what the etymology of Samson is. There's been much discussion. Some think it is sun-like, S-U-N, but again, we don't know. Verse 25, "And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir him." This is a specific occurrence at a particular geographic location that meant the camp of Dan, which shows us the pressure the Philistines and others were putting on Dan, that they weren't living in the cities of their tribal allocation, but living in tents still. Notice we have the Spirit of the Lord here, which of course is the symbol of God's power manifested in the world. We have the angel of the Lord in this chapter, which I think is the pre-incarnate Christ. And we have Yahweh, God the Father. So the Trinity is visible here, though in its Old Testament hiddenness, not in its New Testament fullness. Now notice that, let's see. Let's go to chapter 14 then. "And Samson went down to Timnah." It's about 4 miles from his home. So it's a wine-growing region. We think Timnah means the allotted portion. "And saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines." Now, this is one of those, of course, problem things we learned back in the Genesis where they were to marry within their faith. But here Samson, based simply on the woman's looks, wanted this woman. So he came back and told his father and mother. Now, the father and mother were involved in setting up the marriages. But Samson wanted to pick his own bride. So he was kind of playing with tradition, but he was really violating the honor he should have had for his parents to let them pick a wife for him. And that we begin to catch some truths about Samson. He's a very strong, powerful man, but he's a very lustful man. He doesn't have honor for his parents, and he seems to be on the aggressive side of life. He wants to get all the gusto he can out of life, and that's the kind of man he was. Surprising when you look at him, the moral nature of this judge. "Get her for me as a wife." Parents had to go make the arrangements. But notice where it says a woman in verse 2. Matter of fact, she's mentioned in verse 1, "I saw a woman in Timnah." This is an unusual word for the word woman. It's not the word for virgin of marriageable age. This is usually used for a widow or someone who's divorced. It's a kind of a word for contempt. You may want to see chapter 16, verse 4. Some believe the Jews did this because she was a Canaanite, and that may be true. They switched the normal word here, but it is a different word in verse 1, 2, 3, 7, and 10. Okay, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of your people that you take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" Now, everybody else of the Canaanites were circumcised. Only the Philistines were not. All the Canaanites did it at different times and for different reasons, but they were all circumcised. "Get her from me, for she looks good." It's not real good to pick your mate by how they look, but it doesn't seem to last. However, his father and mother did not know that it was the Lord, for he, capital H, was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, the King James and the Revised Standard Version have a small he in verse 4, but the New English Bible and the New American Standard Version have a capital letter. The capital letter implies it was God that was using Samson's lustful inappropriateness to cause trouble with these Philistines to start a fight between the Jews and them. That's what the implication of the capital letter means. Now, you see, the Philistines had really invaded, but they did it quietly. And they did it through economic reasons, and they didn't do it cruelly. And so the Jews were not upset they were controlled by these people. So Samson's going to cause an international incident to bring this to light and cause them to react against. And I think it seems funny to say that God used this inappropriate lustful feelings, but that seems to be the account here. "Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother. They came to the vineyards of Timnah," a very famous wine-growing region, "and behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, and he tore it as one tears a kid, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father and mother what he had done." Obviously, they went together, but they separated here for some reason. Now, you can't imagine the allegory that's read into this verse. Oh, the lion becomes Satan, and the sweetness becomes salvation, and on. Friends, we've just been told this, so we can set up the riddle down in verse 14. This is not meant to be allegorized. I think not. Notice that it tore him like a kid. Now, this apparently means that preparing a kid to be eaten. So he prepared him, like ripped him apart for food. And notice that it had nothing in his hand. This may refer to the fact that in 1 Samuel 13, 19 through 22, the Jews didn't have many weapons like knives or something to carry because the Philistines had all the metallurgy technology. I'm not sure it's saying that. He just didn't have anything in his hand, a sign of his strength. He did not tell his father or his mother. Why? Apparently, he didn't want to let them know he had touched an unclean body of a lion, which was one of the Nazarite things. He broke all of them, by the way. So he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. And he later returned to her. This seems like to be kind of the normal probation period. Probation, that's not a good word. Betrothal period. Sometimes it could last up to a year, but how long, we don't know. And when he came back, and it had to be some period of time because some bees had made their nest in the carcass of this lion. Now, I'm sure all the flesh had rotten away. It was just kind of the rib cage where these bees had collected. And Samson got some and ate it. Now, the only reason I think he tells all that, and he gave his parents some, didn't tell them where it's from because these were Jews, and I'm sure they'd have been nervous about the food laws to know they ate some honey out of the carcass of an unclean lion, you know. So he didn't tell them. Then they had it was customary for them to have a party in verse 10, and there were 30 companions, Philistine companions, apparently. Now, Josephus says they came to guard Samson because they didn't trust him. That may be true, or it may just have been young men of the city. We just can't be sure. And Samson kind of makes a deal with him. He wants he had paid a dowry for his wife, and apparently he wants to get some of it back. And he makes a riddle, and he kind of makes him a bet, says, I got a riddle you can't solve, and if you solve it, I'll give you 30 changes of garments, and if you can't, you give me that. There's 30 men there. Now, these were not just regular clothes, but party clothes. Really pretty, really fancy. It was one of the sources of wealth in the ancient world. It's a very expensive bet they made, okay? And he tells them a riddle. It's found in verse 14. And there's kind of a time problem here. If you look at the latter part of verse 10, it says, but they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. And then in verse 15, it says, my New American Standard has the fourth day, but in reality, the Hebrew has the Masoretic text, has the word the seventh. But again, look over at verse 17. She wept before him 7 days. And then verse 18, on the seventh day before the sun went down. So you see we have some confusion of the time here. But of course, it doesn't affect the truth of this account. It's just a problem in our copy we have of the Old Testament that, of course, hand copies for thousands of years. Now, then he's going to, the wife is going to say, oh, Samson, please tell me, please tell me. And she cried and begged and pushed him, drove him berserk. Samson was not real good with ladies because Delilah's going to do the same thing in our next lesson. And look at verse 7. She wept before him 7 days. Oh, my soul, what a week. What a marriage festival. Have your wife crying the whole time. You might want to see 16:6 where the same kind of thing happens. Finally, he told her. He said, oh, what's sweeter than honey and what's stronger than a lion? And she ran right off and told these other guys. Because the truth is, if you look at verse 15, they said, lady, how come you invited this party just to rip us off? If you don't find the answer to this riddle, we're going to burn you, burn your father, burn your house. You find the answer. This was not a racial problem. It was purely economic. They weren't mad at her because he's a Jew and you're a Philistine. No, they're mad because they couldn't solve the riddle. It's going to cost them a lot of money. Now, notice look at what Samson says in verse 18. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him. Now, it looks like Samson. The Spirit of the Lord comes on him and leaves. Matter of fact, one of the saddest things I know is in verse chapter 16 where it says the Spirit left Samson and he didn't even know it. Oh, God help us. Came along upon Samson, and boy, he went down to Ashkelon. Now, look at the map again. You'll see that Ashkelon is one of the five cities of the Philistines, along with Ekron and Gath and Ashdod and on and on. Now, so he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 people there. Now, they must have been having a party also because he takes their party clothes, not their regular day clothes or work clothes, but party clothes. So he must have gone to another wedding or another party and killed everybody there and stripped them naked and took their clothes. Ooh, my goodness. And his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house, and he Samson's wife was given to his companion who had been his friend. Now, this is one of the companions at the wedding feast. Now, what is this talking about? Well, apparently Samson got so mad, he kind of gave these guys the clothes and just left the feast. Well, boy, it's embarrassing for this man to have a 7-day feast for his father, very expensive for him, and his daughter not be married. So apparently when Samson went home, he wasn't sure that Samson wanted her. Some say the marriage hadn't been consummated yet. I'm not sure if it was consummated the first night of the party or after the party. I'm not sure. There's a lot of problem here about why did Samson go home and the girl stay there. Some say it's a matriarchal system where the girl stayed in the mother's house. I'm not sure about all that. Samson just got mad and went home. And the father said, well, I'm just going to give my girl to the best man. It'd be embarrassing for her not to be married. Now, this plot is going to thicken, friends. And verse 20 tells us what's going to happen. It's going to make Samson so mad that he's going to take revenge on Philistines. And that's been the purpose of these whole chapters. Samson is an unusual judge. He's an immoral judge. And yet God uses it for the very purpose. His immorality is the occasion for God to do what he wants to do. I think God does use even evil for his purposes. And so here we have a good example of that. The plot is going to thicken as Samson tries to find an account, or really God, through Samson, finds an account to attack the Philistines. There are several manuscript problems and word problems through this account in Judges. And I want to say to you, this book, 26 translations of the Holy Bible, the New Testament is edited by Curtis Vaughn. It's put out by AMG Publishers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, will really help you. What it does is, and this is the Old Testament, volume one of the Old Testament, it gives King James in bold print. And then from a pool of 26 other translations, it picks six other translations that try to catch the sense of the original. So this is going to be very helpful to you. And I think reading Josephus to see what the Jewish tradition in Jesus' day was about Samson. And we're going to pick up on this same account next week as we delve into the thickening plot of Samson's love life, which is a real mess. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.